Fall cleanup projects around the house can be a lot of work, with leaves to rake, gutters to clean, and wood to stack. But donating that old vehicle you no longer use to NHPR is as easy as pumpkin pie. Free up some space in your garage this autumn, all while supporting the public radio programs you rely on. We'll take care of the paperwork and even arrange to tow away your old car, truck, or boat for free. Learn more today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. As cold weather arrives and people move indoors, New Hampshire's coronavirus infections are up. Yesterday, the state had one of the highest numbers of new cases reported since the pandemic began, at 140. So now some Granite Staters are reconsidering fall traditions, whether it's watching football with friends or trick-or-treating on Halloween. And many are having hard conversations about the holiday season just around the corner. Because of all this, there's new interest in so-called pandemic pods or bubbles, small groups of friends who agree on certain rules so they can socialize safely inside. Today in The Exchange, we're with the state's top public health doctors to look ahead and answer your questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Dr. Benjamin Chan. He's the state's epidemiologist, along with Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist, and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Welcome to both of you. I know how busy you are, so I really appreciate your time. And Dr. Chan, to you first, what is behind this alarming increase in infections?
Yeah, so thank you for having us. It's always a pleasure to be on your show and to engage with your listeners. We are seeing increasing community spread, community transmission of COVID-19 across the state. And largely that's due to people relaxing their social distancing. We know that this is a virus that we still believe primarily spreads person to person through close contact. We define that as being within 6 feet. And we know that as this pandemic wears on, we're in this for the long haul, but as it wears on, people are relaxing social distancing, and that is contributing to more and more spread of COVID-19. And so I think it highlights the need for us to continue to be on our guard, be vigilant. There's different, terms being used, but we still very much are in the midst of this pandemic. We don't have a vaccine yet. And until we do, the primary way that we have to control spread of this novel coronavirus is through those community mitigation measures, the social distancing, the cloth face mask use, the good hand hygiene, and especially avoiding crowds where people are together in closed, confined spaces, potentially in close contact in indoor spaces. Those are the settings where this virus likes to spread very easily.
Which we see more of, obviously, as we move indoors. And I want to let listeners know we will definitely talk about vaccines a little bit later in the show, but I'll hold off on that for a moment. So, Dr. Talbot, Dr. Chan mentioned, community spread, people relaxing their vigilance, people moving indoors. Is that what we're seeing now in restaurants, Dr. Talbot? People moving indoors, sitting close together, and you can't eat with a mask on, so there you go.
Thanks, Laura. It's an opportunity to review, as Dr. Chan said, the three C's. So this virus exploits conditions of close contact, closed spaces, crowded conditions, and that can easily call to mind a restaurant. So if you are in those circumstances and you have to take your mask off to eat, this seems like the infamous perfect storm. So indeed, there are studies showing that persons who have COVID-19 often are more likely to report that they have eaten indoors in a restaurant or been in a bar setting. So we know this. The evidence is showing us. It's also intuitive and consistent across everything we know about how this virus behaves.
Some restaurants, Dr. Talbot, have done a good job putting out those big old heaters. Is eating outside that much safer or a little bit safer, Dr. Talbot?
Much safer.
Really?
So we watch very closely what happens internationally and in the research arena. And it does look as though being outside is pretty effective given the extra airflow, the climactic conditions, often with sunlight, et cetera. So indeed, again, we're talking closed spaces, close contact, crowded conditions. Those are the C's that I am using as my mantra these days. So outdoors is better. So, you know, as we're thinking ahead to holidays, can we be creative? Can we think about outdoor turkey barbecues or, you know, bonfires?
It's pretty cold today, Dr. Talbot.
All right, there's no bad weather, just bad clothes, right?
We there you go.
Get out there in New Hampshire. So we have beautiful outdoors, and we need to think about how to creatively engage together outdoors, you know, the Christmas bonfire, that sort of thing. So we're in this together for, as I said, the long haul. This is a marathon, not a sprint. So.
Well, about a month ago, I bought one of those giant porch heaters, and I like to say I bought the last one, I think, that was available in central or southern New Hampshire, because a lot of people, I think, are taking that message to heart. I did want to ask you, Dr. Talbot, you know, I hear both of you saying that largely this rise in infections is people relaxing their guard, people gathering indoors. What about much more widely available testing, though, Dr. Talbot? Is that also why we're seeing a rise in infections?
So before we take that question on directly, I want to also frame this that we're not blaming cases, right? In most cases, that when you hear of someone with disease, that's a tragedy, and that's unfortunate, and it may not be a fault of their own, right? So I just want to make sure that we don't blame individuals, but we look for ways to improve the way that we're all behaving, right? So, and now with regards to whether increased testing is the cause of our increased numbers, I think only to a certain extent. We're using the new tools in the toolkit, the antigen testing especially, to increase our reach and understand the way this virus is moving in especially populations like schools and long-term care facilities. So some of the cases we're identifying are those that perhaps would not have been tested previously. So there is some role of increased testing. But clearly, as we observe hospitalizations and symptomatic cases, that's not the only answer here.
Let's talk exposure and infection. And listeners, by the way, what questions do you have about getting tested and what you're supposed to do if you get a positive result, or what you're supposed to do if you get a phone call saying you were at a place where there was a coronavirus case? We'd love your questions this morning. You can send them in by email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Chan, as you know, lots of headlines about exposure at restaurants. Let's say you were at one of those restaurants on Saturday night. I'm not saying you would eat inside at a restaurant, Dr. Chan, because you probably wouldn't. But let's say I was at a restaurant on Saturday night, and I found out on Sunday there was someone there who tested positive. I got a call from a contact tracer saying, if you were at restaurant X, you should know somebody there had coronavirus. Should I run out and get tested that day? Should I wait a day or two? What's the chain of events there?
Yeah, and actually, Laura, before I jump into that question, I just want to make a brief comment on the last question about, you know, why we're seeing a rise in community transmission. And it's not just due to testing, right? Yes, testing is readily available. People can access testing all throughout the state. We've set a low bar for testing in our colleges and universities and our K-12 schools. But what we're also seeing is the number of hospitalizations beginning to rise. We're seeing the number of people dying from COVID-19 beginning to rise again after a lull during the summer. Part of this is because we're seeing more clusters and COVID-19 being reintroduced back into long-term care facilities and vulnerable populations. So there's a lot of evidence that, and on top of that, our contact investigations are identifying, you know, more and more people coming into close contact with someone with COVID-19. So multiple reasons, multiple data points point to the fact that community spread is increasing. It's not just increased testing. And I think that gets to your current question, which is what happens when somebody is diagnosed with COVID-19? Everybody diagnosed with COVID-19 gets reported to public health, either by the provider that's doing the testing or the laboratory that runs the tests and submits that report to us electronically and automatically. Now, there may be a little bit of a lag between when somebody is notified by a provider, for example, and when we may get the report, but we get all the reports. And when that happens, we reach out to the person infected with COVID-19 and ask them where they have been during their infectious period. And that infectious period is not only the period of time after which they tested positive or were symptomatic, but we go back 2 days, 48 hours before they developed symptoms or before they tested positive, assuming that they could have been spreading COVID-19 even before somebody became symptomatic.
I see.
And based on that information, we reach out to different locations, different organizations to find out who may have been in close contact. Again, that's within 6 feet for at least 10 minutes or longer of that person with COVID-19. And so if that's at a restaurant, we reach out to the restaurant and we try and get information about whether they have collected, you know, information on who was sitting around them, what's the setup of the restaurant, were they in close contact. Anybody that is able to be clearly identified as being in close contact to a person with COVID-19, public health will reach out to and contact directly. There are situations, and we've seen this recently with restaurants, where we may not be able to identify everybody that might have come into close contact with that person, and then we're left doing a public notification, a press release, to try and get the word out that if someone was at, you know, a certain establishment on a certain day or during a certain time, they should be on the lookout for symptoms and be tested because of potential exposure.
I see. So go ahead, Dr. Talbot. Yeah, I can hear you want to jump in.
Yeah, no, that was quite thorough. I am remembering that you asked when testing is appropriate once you've been notified that you may have been a contact to a case. And I think that we've been very, as Dr. Chan said, low bar with regards to accessing testing. So certainly if you have any symptoms, but it is appropriate based on typical incubation period, that is the time from exposure to the time that you might become contagious or symptomatic, say 5 to 7 days following that exposure is probably the most high yield time to be tested, even if you have no symptoms.
I see. So don't, if you find out you were at a place where there was exposure on Saturday night, don't run out and get tested on Sunday, Dr. Talbot. You need to wait a couple days?
Yes, I think that's right. Because, again, the incubation of this virus post-exposure on average is 4 to 5 days, but can linger out to 14 days. So just in terms of a way to maximize yield on testing, probably do it 5 to 7 days after that exposure.
Well, let's go to our listeners. Lots of emails coming in and phone calls as well. Our number 1-800-892-6477. Kelly's calling from Francistown. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in today.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm 65. I'm retired after 34 years from the post office as a letter carrier. I have a business called I have a business, the party bus business. And last job I did was March 14th. With a bunch of doctors, actually, from the Catholic Medical Center. I'm wondering, my bus would have 10 to 14 people in a 4 to 8 hour period visiting maybe 4 to 8 different businesses during that time. The enclosed space of the party bus for the participants would be about 8 feet by 7 feet by 15 feet. And I'm in a separate compartment. We each have separate air, separate heat, and separate ventilation that doesn't intermingle. When might it be safe for me to go back in business and for me and my clients, my family, for me to operate that type of a party bus again?
Sure. And Kelly, just real quickly, please, what does a party bus do? I have to say I haven't been on one.
Well, in December, I'd like to be able to do Christmas light tours, but I think that's going to be out. But
yeah.
Basically, it's anything you want. It's a small bus like your small city buses that would be maybe 25 feet long, and it's like a club. My bus is like a club on wheels. It's got circular seating. It's got TVs. It's got different pictures and pennants and, you know, decorations. It's a party on wheels. It's what it is.
And you maybe go see the Christmas lights, or maybe people like to go on the coast or something like that. So there's sort of attractive scenery that you're looking at while you're having a party. Yeah.
Could I tell you my name?
Sure.
Okay. I was fortunate to come to New Hampshire 3 years ago after doing this 15 years in Vermont.
Yeah.
And my name is New Hampshire Party Bus.
Well, Kelly, thank you very much for calling. And I'm sure this is a very difficult time for you. And Dr. Talbot, you know, you probably can't assess all the parameters right here on the air. But in general, how does this party bus sound to you?
So as we've talked, you know, I've certainly felt a lot of compassion that there are definitely industries, businesses, and things that we do as social humans that are no longer safe. And so as I think about a party bus, it sounds like there's potential for close contact. It's a closed space. And there's likely crowded conditions by nature. So this feels as though it would be dangerous. It might bring us back to the discussion of layers of protection. So, for example, having everyone universally masked doesn't sound like a party to me, but I think that that's the era we're in. Making sure that people can conduct hand hygiene very regularly, where's your Purell right now kind of thing. And then as you foreshadowed, Laura, there may be opportunity to think about pods or bubbles in a party. So if you are being absolutely safe with regards to these issues on social distancing and these strategies and these actions, and your friends and family have also contracted with you to do so, then this is your pod, this is your bubble, and maybe this is your party bus. But I as you say, would have to see the circumstances and the way that these layers fall into place in a way to not further propagate this virus and
sure. In our Well, Kelly, thank you for calling. And it is a tough, tough time for people in business like yours, for sure. Here's an email from Bob in Exeter. And Dr. Chan, I'll throw this to you. I have a lot of concern, Bob says, about the time it takes to get tested. Many people are getting tested and don't know for up to 4 to 5 days if they are positive or negative. For people needing to travel, this will not allow people in New Hampshire to leave, as many places require negative COVID tests within 48 or 72 hours. What is being done, Bob asks, to speed up testing processing times? Go ahead, Dr. Chan, please.
Yeah, so good question from Bob, and I think there's a couple answers. So one is that, you know, I don't think we can necessarily comment on what other states are requiring. You know, there's different types of tests and different test technologies that are out there, and, you know, I think we generally recommend that people look to local public health guidance for where they're traveling to for the most current recommendations. Some states, we are aware, are requiring testing before coming into another state. I will say that as transmission increases across the country, risk of COVID-19 increases across the country, and so we continue to discourage travel, especially on public mass public conveyances. So that's just a little point to put in there. But regarding the question about testing, you know, the turnaround times for the tests have greatly improved from where we were back in the fall and the summer. And so, you know, we periodically are hearing reports of longer turnaround times for testing. But in general, you know, tests are being turned around, we believe, in, you know, 2, maybe 3 days. That's for the PCR-based test. And for anybody that's symptomatic, you know, having symptoms of COVID-19 and needs to be tested, there are antigen tests that are being rolled out to our different regional testing centers, and those can give results within 15 or 20 minutes of testing. Now, we continue to promote and recommend those primarily for people that have symptoms of COVID-19. So if someone's looking for a screening test because they're going to travel, for example, the better and the appropriate test is the PCR-based test, but partly that's going to depend on the requirements for where somebody's traveling to. And I believe Dr. Talbot wanted to jump in there also on the question.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
I've understood that some people really need to travel for work. So they're in my role in the travel clinic up at Dartmouth, I've discovered that there's a whole industry that's sprung up to enable people to meet requirements of the airlines and international border crossing. When it's mission critical travel. So this is self-testing at home for a fee. So this is a new strategy for those kinds of regulatory tests that are required. But otherwise, I fully echo Dr. Chan that We work very hard to bring those testing times down within our state. We're in a pretty good place in that regard. So it's even now available to you to track online on our dashboard. So you can see those turnaround times by accessing our website, and then you can choose your own lab, whoever has the lowest number.
All right, let's take another call. And this is Nancy from Wolfboro. Hi, Nancy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks so much. So my daughter and thousands of others are going to be flying back from college for Thanksgiving. What's the best protocol? I have to pick her up at the airport, so therefore, if she's contaminated, I will be. Should we wait 5 days or 3 days to get tested? And is after we have the test, are we considered safe, and could we have Thanksgiving if we had that period? Some of the college students have insurance that doesn't necessarily pay in New Hampshire. I understand the state is providing free tests. Will they be covered?
Well, Nancy, thank you for calling in, because so many people are asking this question. Beth in Concord actually has a similar question that she wrote in. She says, if your friend served on a local school board and she asked you how to handle the weeks between Thanksgiving and the New Year, when teachers, staff, and family hold gatherings and travel, and might not be completely truthful, how would you advise her? So this is something we need to get into, both of you. And Dr. Chan, I'll turn to you first, but Dr. Talbot, obviously want to hear from you as well. Thanksgiving travel, Dr. Chan, the reports out of Canada are not optimistic. They celebrate Thanksgiving about 2 weeks before we do. And according to reports I was reading yesterday, they have noticed a rise in COVID cases in Canada due to their Thanksgiving. So go ahead, Dr. Chan.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and we're getting a lot of questions now about travel and how people can or should travel safely over the holidays. So I think a couple responses. One is that we are looking at our travel guidance and reevaluating in the setting of, knowing that there will be increased travel coming up. But the guidance right now continues to be that people that are traveling to or from areas outside of New England need to quarantine for 14 days when they get to the state after their travel. And that quarantine period, that 14-day quarantine period, is because that's the time frame, what we call the incubation period, from when somebody is exposed to when they can develop symptoms of COVID-19. And so this puts, I understand, families, communities in tough positions who may have people traveling in from other states outside of New England, even flying in. But as you mentioned, travel is higher risk. And even with testing, testing does not get somebody out of quarantine in New Hampshire. That's something that other states around us, Vermont in particular, have adopted a policy where, if you get tested on day 7, you can end your quarantine early. New Hampshire has not adopted that approach. And so the recommendation currently is still that anybody traveling from outside of New England needs to quarantine for 14 days. But that's something we're looking at to see what other surrounding states are doing and whether we can potentially revise our travel and quarantine policy. So I would say stay tuned. But as you mentioned, you travel, especially public conveyances, travel on public conveyances is higher risk, and potentially it can lead to exposures and COVID, COVID being brought into the state.
Well, so the quarantine in New Hampshire is, you're supposed to do it, Dr. Chan, but there doesn't seem to be any quarantine police. So how effective is that honor system, Dr. Chan?
Yeah, you're right. We have not been going out and serving people public health orders to make sure that they're quarantining after travel. There are instances where we will do that, but we haven't done that when people are supposed to quarantine for travel. So it's on the honor system. But we want to stress the point, though, that even though we leave it up, we leave a lot of these decisions to personal individual responsibility, and I think many people want to do the right thing, the reason for these recommendations is not only to protect, the people in the household that might have, others coming into the state, but also the surrounding community. Once COVID-19 is introduced, it can spread rapidly, and it can lead to further spread in the community. And so, it's not just the person who's infected that is potentially at risk. It's the close contact in the household. And if they come down with COVID-19, they're close contacts in the community. And if somebody works, for example, at a long-term care facility, you know, there could be chains of transmission that lead to COVID-19 spreading within our communities.
So should Nancy's daughter not come home? These are the decisions that parents are having to make. It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. We're all individually, personally, professionally impacted, as we've already heard. And my own Thanksgiving will be intimate, more than usual. We're just going to have a core, our own family bubble, and that's sad. We are all grieving the normal life of these large and boisterous and happy holidays. I think that every decision we're taking now is risk and benefit. So we need to talk more about that, Dr. Chan.
Yeah, and I'll just add that, you know, we're not saying that the college student can't come home, right? We understand that there are important family and social functions that need to occur. We're simply, I think, recommending that people take the appropriate precautions, and that person coming home from out of state, out of New England, that individual is recommended to quarantine, meaning not go out in public places. But that doesn't mean that the person can't, you know, fly home for several weeks and quarantine in a parent or a guardian's house and have Thanksgiving. But again, we want to stress that those social gatherings are situations that are high risk. And so we continue to recommend that those social gatherings be, you know, a limited number of people, preferentially outdoors, although that may be difficult. And so if people are indoors, trying to, you know, practice social distancing indoors and good hand hygiene and wear cloth face coverings where possible.
Well, Nancy, thank you for calling. And I would say, in terms of this 2-week quarantine, a lot of colleges are sending students home for Thanksgiving and keeping them studying remotely until, you know, after the new year. So maybe that helps a little bit with some of those quarantine issues. Another call, Molly is calling from Andover. Hi, Molly, you're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi there. I have 3 school-age children, and our school is currently in hybrid mode. And a recent school board meeting, they decided to continue in hybrid mode. And I know a lot of other schools are considering going remote as cases get higher. I'd like Dr. Chan to please comment on the transmission rate in the schools, specifically compared to the community rates. And if schools are practicing social distancing in the classrooms with masks on, why are we continuing to have restaurants and bars open and no mask mandate while we're shuttering our schools? As we know, unemployment benefits have been cut off for a lot of people, the additional, and families are struggling economically, and it's a huge stress, and kids are really suffering right now. So I want to know if it's warranted that some school districts are actually closed.
Yeah, Molly, thank you for calling. And Dr. Chan can't really comment on the economic, the idea of unemployment insurance and so forth, because he's a public health doctor. But to the decisions, Dr. Chan, that school districts are having to make, you know, opening, closing, going hybrid, how are you guys helping them make those decisions? What metrics are you advising them to use?
Yeah, so these decisions about school instructional models is a local school district, school board decision. We have been supporting schools to help put out information. We've been holding weekly calls with school partners, and we have put out guidance for schools specifically around this question of how and when schools can consider transitioning between instructional models. And a school's ability to function is, I think, there's 2 different factors that play in, right? One is what's happening in the broader community, the community transmission. And the other is what's happening at local, specific, individual schools. And so this guidance tries to define and take into account both factors. But to Molly's question, you know, as community transmission increases, the risk to organizations, businesses, schools, and the communities will also increase. And so schools do need to take into account levels of surrounding community transmission. And we've made metrics and data available to schools and to the public on our, interactive, data dashboard. But I think one of the key points here is that we have seen you know, I don't have an exact number, but probably around 200 students and staff in the last, you know, 2-3 months that have been associated with K through 12 schools, but very little in-school transmission. You know, I think we have a total of about 5 small clusters that have occurred within K through 12 schools over the last, you know, 2 or 3 months. And so even with the high number of students and staff that are being diagnosed, we have not seen a lot of in-school transmission. And I think that speaks to the two things. One is that the layers of protection that schools are implementing is working. And the second is that, you know, schools can be conducted safely in person, whether that's full in person or in hybrid. And so we continue to support schools in trying to make these decisions. But ultimately, the decision on what learning model is used it comes down to the decisions by the local school district and school board.
All right. Lots more to talk about, but we have to take a very short break. When we come back, we will get the latest on vaccine development and some new treatments that might be coming down the line. And we'll keep answering your questions. So send them in. We'd love to hear from you. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. More of the exchange in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, New Hampshire's top public health doctors are with us, and we're talking about the latest with coronavirus in New Hampshire as cases rise due to community transmission as people head indoors. What are your questions for Dr. Chan and Dr. Talbot? Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org, and we will try to get to as many of your questions as possible. Both of you, Dr. Talbot, you first, please. What are you watching with vaccine trials? Every time we talk about this. So go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
I'm watching very closely, Laura, because...
Yeah, me too.
Like many others, I'm just so hopeful that this is what's going to turn our epidemic, our pandemic around and get us back to normal. So I don't know. I don't have that crystal ball, but I do know that there are 4 late-stage phase 3 vaccines that there's much optimism for, and even a 5th that's about to enter into the late-stage trials will need to show a safe and effective vaccine. So I want to convey that we are working so hard to put together an equitable, appropriate distribution plan with the assumption that we will get that safe and effective vaccine in the coming weeks and months. We'll prioritize those who suffer the most through illness and death for this vaccine, and also our frontline healthcare workers deserve our protection first with this vaccine as it comes to us.
Why, Dr. Talbot, does the timeline seem to keep getting bumped out? At first, we thought we'd have vaccines by January, then it was March, now I'm hearing June. Can you just explain why that happens?
I can try. As I understand it, of course, vaccines all have to come through 3 phases of development. So I've already made reference to phase 3, which is conducted in tens of thousands of patients, 30,000 in each of these trials, 44,000 in one of the trials. These are a lot of people, and the vaccine companies have to target those who are going to give us the most valuable information, those where the virus is actually circulating, those who are most vulnerable to disease, those that might be vulnerable to side effects from the vaccine, such as those who are pregnant or elderly. So to accrue those large numbers of persons, including those who are in minorities and with comorbidities, just health problems, it takes weeks, it takes months. And then the vaccine will be considered by our scientific and regulatory agency, the Food and Drug Administration. They will look at all the data, which is a monumental task, and make sure also that they have at least 2 months of safety follow-up from the last vaccinee. So when you plot this out on a timeline, it is dynamic. And it is all in service of a safe and effective vaccine. So we have to be patient as we all want that vaccine to come to us and turn this thing around.
Let's take another call. This is Suzanne in Keene. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air. Yes. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. My concern is what I just observed in the community. Recently driving to work, I saw a group of high school students standing very close together, unmasked. A patient of mine recently commented that a customer threw their purse at her when the customer was asked to put a mask on. I'm concerned that as physicians, I'm a physician, and especially physicians in the public health sector, that we're not doing enough to educate the community that wearing masks is something that we do for each other, and I don't understand why masks haven't been mandated in New Hampshire.
Suzanne, I'm so glad you called. And Dr. Chan, this has come up a lot, especially recently with the debates. Governor Sununu said a mask mandate, he didn't feel it was necessary statewide right now, but he's relying on the advice of your team, and that might be coming down the road. So what are the metrics around what would make you, Dr. Chan, say, you know, I think we need this?
Yeah, so it's a good question and one that comes up frequently. And this decision on masks is one that unfortunately has become controversial and political. We continue to strongly recommend and encourage that everybody who is out in a public setting wear a mask. That mask is intended to protect other people around the person wearing the mask and is one of the ways that we have to control spread of COVID-19. I am aware that the CDC is working on trying to put out further information and further messaging on mask use so that we can try and use science and have better engagement on this issue. But at the end of the day, this is one of the layers that we continue to look at and discuss promote mask use for everybody to try and prevent and control spread of COVID-19.
Is there a number, Dr. Chan, you know, where hospitalizations reach X level or deaths reach X level, where you say to the governor, you know, I think we really need to do this? Is it a feel thing or is it a data thing?
It's a good question. There's not a specific metric or a specific number at which, you know, mask use would become mandated. You know, certainly we continue to recommend mask use as one of the layers of protection, but we need to remember and use masks in the context of all the other, you know, recommendations: social distancing, avoiding crowds, avoiding, you know, close contact in confined spaces. So there's not a specific metric, but certainly it's an area of ongoing discussion.
Well, and Suzanne's a doctor asking about mask mandates. Bobby in Newfields wrote in. He's a physician. He says, I am the town health officer, and I am often asked by people, including my patients and people in town, to, quote, produce the evidence that masks and facial coverings are proven to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Bobby says, other than saying it is intuitive and that any barrier can help to a degree, I am often at a loss of what to say to help folks embrace mask wearing indoors. Bobby asks, and Dr. Talbot, I'll throw this to you, do you have any suggestions for a good fact-based answer to this question that can help folks understand? Bobby, thank you so much. And Dr. Talbot, go ahead.
I'm very happy to be able to answer this question. There is no controversial data. That is, there's no evidence against masks. In fact, all the evidence is coming to us from every setting that the proper mask works. So we have an effective tool that evidence shows us, studies show us. It's not just intuitive, right? So I particularly draw in conversations with other clinicians on a great Lancet review showing the evidence. They've summarized it in a way that's very palatable, very understandable, and I pull it out often. They even have an infographic, if you will, for posting places. So please do find your talking points to encourage, to enable one another to wear a mask. We're seeing that the arguments and the fights and the conflict over masks is not productive. But I continue to hope and believe that evidence will show people that this is effective. There's no question, there's no metric any longer that this is effective. So you know, we need to own that, and we need to think about the ways that we communicate that effectively to our friends, our neighbors, our patients, et cetera. Whether it's through a mandate, I doubt. I think that really this is a grassroots opportunity for us to talk to one another in credible, believable, trustworthy ways. But this is not a political issue. This is a life or death issue for many people. And I'd like to offer, too, that as we learn more, one of the things that emerges for me as very important for discussion is so-called long COVID, that as we watch outcomes for persons, clearly most people recover and get better. But there is increasing evidence that this virus continues to show us new terrible tricks. And that is, it can damage hearts and lungs and your energy for months after infection. So this is not only getting over the acute phase, but really looking down the long road. So long COVID is a new entity that we're paying attention to and further invigorates this effort at advocacy around wearing masks. This is evidence-based. We can do this together. We have to think of creative ways to encourage one another.
So in terms of Bobby and Suzanne, who want that sort of basic argument, Dr. Talbot, you're saying The Lancet, which is a British medical journal, they've done sort of the best job in terms of putting that basic information out there in a fact-based, easy-to-understand way?
That's right. This is a so-called meta-analysis and a systematic review looking at the evidence of this virus and similar viruses such as SARS-CoV-1 and MERS-CoV, where masks can reduce the rate of transmission, mostly in healthcare settings, but I think that is referenceable to general public and community.
Okay, and in terms of long haulers, long-term illness, I have another question for you, Dr. Chan, on that, but I'm going to save it for after a quick break. Henry and Keen wrote in, so I will throw his question to you, Dr. Chan. He's got questions about what Dr. Talbot just mentioned, you know, people having impacts a long time after their initial diagnosis. We'll keep taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is great. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, New Hampshire's top public health doctors are talking about coronavirus and the spread here in the state. Also, people looking again at their holiday traditions this fall and winter. Now, in a moment, we will turn to pandemic pods or bubbles. That's where you can socialize as safely as possible with a small group of people. But before we do, Dr. Chan, I did want to share an email from Henry and Keen, who asks about long-term illness, long haulers, so to speak. Henry says, I would like to ask Dr. Chan about the lack of public education concerning the long-term effects of COVID-19 in patients who have, quote, recovered, and yet are suffering from ongoing myocardial inflammation, pulmonary concerns, multiple organ failures, elevated risk of blood clotting, and chronic physical and mental fatigue. Henry says, to this day, there have been around 30,000 studies pertaining to these effects. Yet aside from the occasional short news story, this is not being talked about. Henry says, are we putting more young people at risk of chronic diseases by downplaying the side effects? Henry, thank you for writing. Dr. Chan, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's a great question. And one of the things that we wanted to bring up to your listeners on the call today is that as this pandemic progresses, we're learning more about how COVID-19 presents and the various syndromes that it presents with, and also the potential for long-term consequences, the long-term health conditions from COVID-19. This is not just people that are older or people with chronic medical conditions. There are reports and evidence that even in young, healthy people, COVID-19 can cause long-term health complications and health problems. And the listener, I believe Henry, highlighted some of them, right? It's not just issues of chronic fatigue or sometimes what people call, you know, brain fog, difficulty concentrating. But we're hearing reports of chronic lung problems, chronic, you know, cough and difficulty breathing and damage to the lungs, even heart injury, where there's heart muscle inflammation that can lead to long-term cardiac problems. And these are situations that are being reported, again, not just in older individuals or people with chronic medical conditions, but in young, otherwise healthy people. So it's going to be probably an increasingly recognized problem. And one of the reasons we continue to stress that people take this pandemic and this virus seriously. You know, I think a lot of what we've heard the last, you know, couple months are people relaxing restrictions because people may not think it poses a significant health threat to themselves or their children or their teenagers. But we certainly want to push the message out there. It's not just about, you know, community spread. It's not just the fact that somebody can get COVID-19 and spread it to other people in the community, potentially more vulnerable individuals. There's increasing evidence that COVID-19 can cause long-term chronic health conditions, even in otherwise young, healthy people.
That's a hard message to convey, Dr. Chan, to young people who, in general, my observation has been they're getting the message about not wanting to infect their elders, but I don't hear them, Dr. Chan, as concerned about their own possible COVID status. You know, they say, hey, I know so-and-so, he got it, he's fine. I would be fine too. I just don't want to infect mom or grandma.
That's right. And I think that's one of the challenges and something that I think, as your caller points out, we can and need to do probably a better job messaging. It's not just about preventing it from spreading, you know, person to person. That's obviously a core part of what we do. But we also want to protect the individual's health, protect individual people and families from not only the immediate acute implications of COVID-19, but the long-term health problems that could arise as well, especially as we are still learning about this virus.
Well, and as both of you know, on the flip side of this whole health concern is the mental health concerns, people being isolated from each other, people being afraid of infection and so forth. And so toward that end, Dr. Talbot, some folks are forming what are called pandemic bubbles or pandemic pods with members outside their family. What makes a pandemic bubble or a pandemic pod work well, Dr. Talbot?
That there is a full adherence to the measures as discussed. So for the pod or bubble to work, everyone needs to stand shoulder to shoulder from 6 feet away and absolutely limit their exposures in the communities and stop attending in-person social events in the spirit of the three C's and all. So this will be a opportunity for extraordinary trust and solidarity when you establish a pod or a bubble. So in the current epidemiology, in the way that this virus is rising in our society, this will be increasingly important that there can be no missteps in a safe pod or safe bubble community.
What's a misstep, Dr. Talbot? Where might this fall short?
That urge to go out to the restaurant. The inclination to stop at the pub on the way home from work. The I don't need a mask. I'm 18 and I'll do fine. You know, any of those things that we've already talked about thematically, that this is 100% adherence to avoiding the three C's, to the universal mask wearing, the face covering, the use of hand hygiene after you touch commonly touched surfaces in our public arena, such as in grocery store, shopping cart handles and doorknobs and handrails, et cetera. So this will require a commitment, you know, not as far as a contract, but definitely a kind of social contract that you need to trust your pod members, your bubble members, and do that with incredible attention because people's lives depend on it.
Yeah. Dr. Chan, I'd like to ask you about this too. Again, you know, I've been paying a lot of attention to the pandemic itself, but I've also been paying a lot of attention to the psychological impacts. And we don't want a mental health pandemic to accompany this physical health pandemic. So what are your thoughts on pandemic bubbles, Dr. Chan, and how to make them work?
Yeah. And let me first say, it's not one or the other, right? It's not either you control the virus or you let it run rampant and let people have their social freedom, right? There's a way of doing both. And I think that that's where we keep talking about the layers of protection. And it's not any one specific intervention that is going to lead to ultimate control of this virus. It's not just mask use. It's not just social distancing. It's not just cohorting. But I think it's when you look at all of those in combination together where we get the best and the maximal control, and also allow people the flexibility to, you know, address the emotional, social needs that they have for getting together with others in the community, but doing so safely, right? And so I think these bubbles or these pods are one way that people can balance trying to limit potential spread of COVID-19 in communities while also having the necessary community social interactions, which we all need to address, you know, the emotional, mental health issues, fatigue that we're feeling from this pandemic. And so, you know, this would fall under the idea of cohorting, what we call cohorting in schools or in public settings. You know, cohorting as families and social groups essentially is forming these bubbles and these pods, so that if somebody comes down with COVID-19, and if there is spread, that is potentially limited to a smaller number of people. And so it goes back to this idea of avoiding, you know, frequent close contact with multiple people and public crowded conditions. How do you contain that? Cohorting or bubbling or having these pods is one way to do that.
Why do you think, Dr. Chan, it's so hard for people to get that message, you know, avoid groups, avoid spending too much time indoors with others? I mean, we hear the message again and again, and yet, you know, it's still going on.
Yeah, and I think people were following recommendations much more strictly early on in the pandemic. And I think one of the challenges that we continue to be faced with, especially as this pandemic drags on, right? We've been in this for at least 8 months now since our first case in New Hampshire. You know, 8 months of
during
the public message of you need to social distance, you need to avoid crowds and gatherings and wear masks. That 8 months is a really, really long time, and I think it's wearing on people, and people want to get back to normal. And it's one of the challenges that we're fighting against is, you know, we will not be back to normal for quite a while, for months. But there is a way that people can control or limit spread of COVID-19, but still have those necessary family and social interactions. And so that's what we continue to try and message is trying to have people find that balance.
Well, and for many, many people, myself included, physical exercise is another way to reduce the mental stress of all this. And Dr. Talbot, I have two questions about exercise. Lisa says, wondering about playing tennis indoors, a high ceiling, three courts without masks. And Bruce says, is there any evidence of increased transmission at gyms, or is an increase expected as more people move their exercise activities inside and doors and windows are closed? And it certainly has been getting cold this week. So real quickly, Dr. Talbot, can you address the need for exercise? But some people have to do it indoors.
Yeah, no, I certainly affirm the need for exercise. I hope that some of it can be novel outside. Maybe this is the time for folks to discover snowshoeing or cross-country skiing or whatever else they've been thinking of doing in the outside arena we have here in New Hampshire. But with regards to indoor, Lisa wants to play tennis. That's a sport I love as well. I think there are there have to be intentional strategies to make that safe. Clearly, you're more than 6 feet apart, but can you do that when you change sides on the court? Can you have different color balls for each player so that you're not creating the potential for spread through handling the ball? Can you make sure you use only your racket? And what about going in and out? And how about the locker room and such? So everything we're doing anymore has to be intentional in this regard. So indeed, the closed spaces of gym where there can be heavy, forceful breathing is a potential place of spread. So the Purell, the washing the stations, wearing a mask even when you're breathing hard, it's all intentional as we weigh the safety of all the activities that we need to engage in to remain physically and emotionally healthy.
Well, Dr. Talbot, you know, we've talked about all these challenges and the frustration that Dr. Chan expressed that we're still stuck with this thing almost 8 months. Dr. Talbot, anything positive you can leave us with?
Oh, yes. Thank you for that opportunity.
Good.
Exactly. I mean, we highlighted that we're getting evidence about what does work. People are tired of hearing about masks, but I think we need to adjust our messaging that the evidence is coming to us very consistently. That's a tool. We have better diagnostics. So you've heard of the rapid antigen tests that are being deployed strategically in our state. You've heard that there's a very intentional pipeline to bring us the safe and effective vaccine. We have new treatments. You've heard of remdesivir, I think, on this call before. But there are other strategies such as monoclonal antibodies. We know a lot in the clinical arena about safe ways to support people who are sick. And again, there are scientific breakthroughs happening at an unprecedented pace as our society rises to this tremendous challenge we've been faced with this pandemic.
Well, I really appreciate both of you, you know, helping us keep track of how this is playing out here in New Hampshire. I'm very appreciative of your time. Dr. Chan, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Benjamin Chan. He's the state's epidemiologist. And Dr. Talbot, a big thank you to you, too.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, deputy epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Today's program was produced by Exchange producer Christina Phillips. Thanks for listening. This is The Exchange on NHPR.